So this is an article or an essay written by Paul Kingsnorth, published in the February 2015 issue of Tricycle, which is a Zen publication, and it's a special. It was in a special section on the witness, and the title is Opening Our Eyes to the Nature of This Earth. The greatest ecological crisis in the Earth's history began with the emission of climate-changing gases by an organism that had spread widely across the planet, colonizing many of its ecological niches. These gases, the waste products of its lifestyle, gradually accumulated in the atmosphere. For a long time, nothing noticeably changed, but at some stage, a tipping point was reached, and the planet's climate flipped rapidly from one state to another. The composition of the atmosphere changed, becoming poisonous to most life on Earth, and the planet's mean temperature plunged, precipitating a global ice age. The resulting mass extinction killed perhaps 90% of all living things on Earth. This was 2.3 billion years ago. The climate-changing organisms were bacteria, and the poisonous gas they emitted was oxygen. Without the planetary catastrophe they precipitated, you and almost everything you know about life on Earth would never have come about at all. All told, there have been at least 5, and perhaps as many as 20, mass extinction events in the history of Earth. This first one, known as the Great Oxygen Catastrophe, was the most far-reaching. The last, 66 million years ago, is the one that we know best because it is the most appealing to the human imagination. It wiped out the dinosaurs. Overall, it is estimated that about 98% of all organisms that have ever existed are now gone forever. All created things perish, said Gautama Buddha. Whatever is subject to origination is subject to cessation. This, it turns out, is true of an individual, a species, an ecosystem, or a planetary epoch. Whatever the Buddha saw under the Bodhi tree, whatever it was that showed him the ceaselessly changing nature of all things and convinced him of the misery caused by attempting to cling to temporary states of apparent stability, has been more than borne out by the consequent studies of the Earth's geology, ecology, and biology. The nature of this Earth is change. The nature of this Earth is endings. The nature of this Earth is extinction. As you read this, the Earth is currently experiencing the latest extinction event in its 4.6 billion year history. This one, known as the Holocene extinction, is being caused not by cyanobacteria or asteroid impacts, but by human beings. Arguably, it has been going on for at least 10,000 years since the extinction of the great megafauna, the mammoth, the ground sloths, the saber-toothed cats, who in all likelihood were pushed over the brink by human hunters. But it has accelerated greatly since the Industrial Revolution and has gone into overdrive in the last half century. The current extinction rate is estimated at anything between 100 and 10,000 times the expected rate of quote-unquote background extinction. And as the expansion of the human economy continues with its associated resource extraction, fossil fuel combustion, population increase, and mass destruction of ecosystems, the Holocene extinction is accelerating beyond our ability to even accurately measure it, let alone put any kind of brake on its progress. What does this mean for us as individuals? If it is our generation's burden to live through this latest collapse in global ecological diversity, the knowledge that we are all complicit increases the burden. Simply being human at this time of history, and particularly being a middle-class human in one of the world's richer nations, makes you and me agents of extinction. Much of the Earth's natural wealth and beauty is disappearing, and as our species treats the planet like a giant quarry or factory floor. The Earth's climate is changing once again. Tipping points are being reached. Much of nature as we know it, is dying away in order that we may have access to smartphones, to-go coffee, private cars, airplane flights, and Facebook. For nearly two decades, starting in the early 1990s, I was involved in environmental activism. That is to say, I worked, as many others did, to try to fend off the worst of the damage that humans are doing to the rest of life on Earth. Some of the campaigns I was involved in were successful, and others weren't. This was always a hard battle, and mostly a losing one. But as time went on, the losing seemed to deepen. It seemed clear that green campaigners were being overwhelmed on all fronts. Such was the size and the momentum of the human economy. Such was its need for growth, simply to keep itself functioning. Such was the level of denial and demand among most human beings, who, despite our qualms, if we had any, would probably not sacrifice most of the baubles and benefits that the economic machine gives us, that the chances of preventing the Holocene extinction from rolling onward came to seem essentially non-existent. Environmental campaigning, like any form of politics, is predicated on control. It is about preventing negative things from happening and trying to channel society toward what you regard as more positive values and systems. It took me a long time to admit to myself that the level of control I wanted and desired simply couldn't exist. Governments had been promising to act on climate for 20 years, and precisely nothing had happened. All of the trends, from extinction to soil erosion to ocean acidification to rainforest destruction, were going in the wrong direction, fast. We, the Greens, knew what needed to be done, but we had no power to make it happen. It wasn't working. I looked around me at the diminishing natural beauty and the accelerating destruction, and I despaired. A few things saved me eventually from this despair. One of them was a geological perspective. We tend to look at the world through an anthropocentric lens. Human concerns are foremost in our vision, bounded by our short lives and our everyday needs and desires. Among those desires is a concern that what we have always known as nature should continue as we have always known it. But nature has taken many forms. For the vast majority of its existence, nature, here on Earth, consisted only of single-celled organisms. The brief period of climatic stability in which human civilizations have evolved is just that, a brief period. It is not any kind of norm, for there is no norm. Had it not been for the great oxygen catastrophe or the asteroid impact that wiped out the dinosaurs or who knows how many other such episodes, none of us would be here to agonize about the latest turbulent episode in the history of this planet. Why should the state of the planet to which we have adapted survive forever? Nothing does. The Earth is a process as much as it is a thing. It is constantly changing. At this point in its history, we are the force tipping it into a new state. Now we are going to have to live with that state, whatever it brings, if we can. All of this, or all of which, brings me by a long and winding road to Buddhism. Having sulked around on the edges of Buddhism, having skulked around on the edges of Buddhism for many years, often unknowingly, I attended my first retreat only last year. I didn't have any expectations, there was just a draw. But something opened up to me during that 5 days of silence and contemplation and self-questioning. I realized, as I had never realized before, that the world and my perceptions of the world were not the same thing. As I write it down now, it seems embarrassingly obvious. But there is a difference between knowing something intellectually and knowing it at a deeper level toward which the Dharma points. I look at a forest. You look at a forest. We see different things. Perhaps one of us sees planking or sawdust or biological diversity or spiritual retreat or silence or rare insect life or certain mosses or a quality of light. Yet none of what we see has any relevance to the forest itself or any of the organisms that make up its whole. It's just what is. It's just there. What does this mean? What it has meant for me is that I am now able to begin, only to begin, mind you, separating reality from my view of it, and to understand the emotional projections that I overlay onto the world I walk through. One of those projections is a sense of what nature is and should be, and how I should be able to maintain it in a certain state. Nature itself, meanwhile, has no such sense of that state. It has no sense that it is nature at all. Nature is made up of a vast and detailed complex of living things doing what they do. Our self-consciousness and our needs are part of that complex, but nature doesn't need us, and extinction as a concept is something that only humans worry about. It is hard for us to take in the reality that the Earth is an extinction machine. It doesn't need us, and we cannot control it. The so-called ecological crisis we hear so much about, and which I have written so much about and worked to stave off, well, who says it is a crisis? Humans do, and educated, socially concerned humans at that. For the Earth itself, the Holocene extinction is not a crisis, it is just another shift. Who determines that the planet should remain in the state in which humans find it conducive? Is it not a form of clinging to mutable things, and one that is destined to make us unhappy? When we campaign to save the Earth, what are we really trying to save? And which Earth? And yet, something I've come to understand slowly over my lifetime is that nature, Earth, the world, whatever you call it, is not simply something I am on, but something I am. It is not outside of me. It is me, and I am it. There is no outside. Nature, as a concept, has always been flawed. Many traditional societies had no word for nature as something separate from humanity because there was no obvious reason to separate humans from everything else that lived. There still isn't any. Felt experiences of deep connection with all life are a central part of virtually all spiritual traditions, and with good reason. Nature is us, and we are nature. The poet Robinson Jeffers describes one of those epiphanic experiences powerfully in his verse drama, The Tower Beyond Tragedy. Quote, I entered the life of the brown forest and the great life of the ancient peaks. The patience of stone, I felt the changes in the veins. In the throat of the mountain, a grain of many centuries. We have our own time, not yours, and I was the stream, draining the mountain wood, and I the stag drinking, and I was the stars, boiling with light, wandering alone, each one the lord of his own summit, and I was the darkness. Outside the stars, I included them. They were a part of me. How can I express the excellence I have found that has no color but clearness, no honey but ecstasy? I can understand and be awed by the ever-changing nature of this ever-changing earth. I can appreciate my own smallness and know the importance of not clinging to temporary states. I can sometimes chide myself for my arrogance in assuming that what I appreciate as nature is some unchanging state that should be preserved for my benefit or even that of my species. Every extinction, after all, is also an opportunity. If the dinosaurs had survived, there would have been no humans. Everything changes, and the changes are not always pretty. Who said they had to be pretty? But when all of this is said, if I see an old-growth forest being logged, I will lie down in front of the logging trucks. If I see a river being poisoned, I will want to stop it from happening. I can't abide factory farms or oil terminals or the destruction of clean air and open space. I have a sense of ecological justice that comes from something far deeper than mere principle. Because I am here, because I am nature, because I am earth, these things to me are a violation of something sacred. And this sense of violation comes with a strong desire to try to prevent such wrongs from being enacted, even if the trying may in the end turn out to be futile. How to square this circle? It was one of the questions I asked the teacher at the first retreat of mine last year. The world may be ever-changing, I said, and my perception of it may not relate in any way to its reality, yet when I look through the window at this wild landscape, I know that I would want to protect it if it were threatened. I feel a sense of what nature needs and what my duty is here. What is the reality of this? Is it an illusion I should try not to cling to? And if it is, Does a Buddhist response demand passivity in the face of destruction because clinging causes pain? Can this be right? And my teacher, who is from the Zen tradition, said simply, sit with it. Sit with what is and what you are and watch it. If you are concerned about the forest, go to the forest. Sit with the forest and pay attention, and then you may know what to do. I have always remembered this response. It reminded me of the deep sanity of the Buddhist worldview, the connected coolness beyond both emotion and reason, which is what attracted me, I think, to begin with. Sit with the forest. Sitting with the forest is what I have been doing all my life. I have long felt there is a language we civilized humans have forgotten how to speak. The spiritual writer and thinker Thomas Berry called this the Great Conversation, and he was clear about its significance. Quote, we are talking only to ourselves. We are not talking to the rivers. We are not listening to the wind and the stars. We have broken the great conversation. By breaking that conversation, we have shattered the universe. All the disasters that are happening now are a consequence of that spiritual autism. Unquote. Any worldview that makes sense, I think now, must orbit around compassion. Sitting with the forest, sitting with other beings, sitting with other people until you are beyond your mere self and can begin to contemplate theirs, seems to me to be the still point of the turning world. Putting it into practice is the hardest work, for me at least. I am a novice, and compassion does not come naturally to me. But while I can see the danger in seeking to control the earth, to define and lock down a version of nature that suits us, to freeze time, to put humans at the heart of things, I can see the danger also inherent in too much sitting. While you sit, the world may be burning around you. While you sit, others may be active, and their form of action may result in destruction and abuse. There is a danger in assuming we know what the earth needs from us, but there is a danger in ceding ground to the powers that run the system that grind this world into dust in the name of money. One story about the life of the Buddha has always fascinated me. Gautama is sitting beneath the Bodhi tree, having attained his enlightenment. Mara, the personification of demonic temptation, demands that Gautama produce a witness to confirm his Buddhahood. Gautama simply reaches down and touches the soil he sits on. The earth is my witness, he says. Mara vanishes. What does this mean? I'm not a scholar, but I can say what it means to me. It means that if you make nature your witness, and if you act as a witness for nature too, there is a truth to be found. It even means, perhaps, that the ultimate witness to who we are comes from the earth itself. When you sit with the earth, when you make it your witness, and when you act as a witness for it, what do you see? What are you compelled to do? These are the questions that take us beyond political stances, beyond principles, beyond arguments about enlightenment or detachment. Beyond arguments about engagement or detachment. They are questions, it seems to me, that can never be answered in any other way other than the strictly personal. Sitting or acting, engagement or retreat, perhaps there need be no contradiction. A great change is underway across the earth. We cannot prevent it now, and its outcomes are not going to be pretty for much of humanity. The nature of nature has always been change, which means that death and rebirth will always be with us. And that rebirth may take forms we do not recognize and did not expect. You are part of this process, and so am I. And this time around, we are the cause of it, too. The future offers chaos, uncertainty, loss. To deny this is to deny reality. To pretend that we have more control than we have, to cling to glib solutions, quote-unquote, as if the world were a math puzzle that we could solve with the right equations, is a similar form of denial. There is an abyss opening up before us. It challenges everything we thought we knew about our culture and about nature. We need to look into it and concentrate on what we can see. Sit with it, the teacher said. It's a common Zen response, and though some see it as a kind of shoulder shrugging, to me it looks like the opposite. What it really says is, pay attention. Our culture is hopeless at paying attention. It glorifies action and belittles contemplation. Responses to the ecocide currently unfurling around us are usually couched in aggressive demands for immediate action. Any action, it seems, however ineffective, is better than none. But it doesn't work like that. My years in green activism have shown me that false hope is worse than no hope, and that ineffective action leads only to despair, particularly if frantic movement is a substitute for facing up to the realities of our limited powers. Sooner or later, that dam will burst. Before you can act on anything with effectiveness, you have to understand it. And that is where the sitting comes in. That is where the attention matters. That is when the stripping back of yourself before the indifference of nature will come to serve you. What happens if you sit with the earth? If you reach down and touch it? If you call it as your witness? What happens if you let your own needs and demands fall away and see the world outside you for what it is? I would suggest that, with the right amount or the right quality of attention, we may come to know what is right for us as individuals and what we can usefully do. This doesn't mean that all will be well. All will not be well. It doesn't mean we will necessarily end up any less confused or conflicted either. It doesn't mean we will never again experience the despair of knowing what we have done and what we are still doing, and of all the things we are losing and can never bring back. But it does mean, or it could, that we are able to hold these feelings within us, to understand them and maybe reconcile them. It does mean that we can be done with denial and projection and false hope and false hopelessness. If we sit with the earth, with the trees and the soil and the wind and the mist, and pay attention, we may know what to do and how to begin doing it, whatever burden we carry with us as we walk. The following is an interview with Paul Kingsnorth that's also posted on the Tricycle website.
It's almost impossible to look at natural beauty without thinking about what humans are probably going to come along and do to it at any minute. And on this retreat, I was able to see that that was something that I was projecting onto the places I was in, which had no particular relevance to those places. Somebody else could have stood exactly where I stood and seen entirely different things. It was nothing to do with what was actually going on in the world. It was nothing to do with physical reality. It was everything to do with the stories I was projecting onto it. And that was a very powerful experience, very liberating one. Because to understand that we're all, every landscape we walk through, we're almost reaching out and imposing our stories and our needs and our desires and our affirmations onto everything and everyone that we see.
Paul Kingsnorth is an English writer and a former environmental activist. After 2 decades of activism, Kingsnorth despaired and withdrew from the campaigning and marching. In 2009, he co-founded the Dark Mountain Project, a collective of artists and storytellers searching for new narratives about the human relationship with the earth. Recently, Kingsnorth has been drawn to Buddhist ideas and started practicing Zen meditation. He's one of the contributors to Tricycle's spring issue special section on extinction. His deep emotional connection to the natural world stretches back to his childhood.
When I look back on it, that some of the quite intense experiences, I suppose, I just had alone on mountains as a child, sunk into me at a level that I didn't understand at the time. But there was something about the wild world, the natural world, the world beyond cities and human organization that spoke to me deeply and still does. And that's the driving force behind the lifelong obsession I've had with nature and the human relationship with it, really, and which has manifested itself in many different ways. When I was a student, I went to university and I discovered kind of radical politics, as so many students do. And in my case, it was environmental activism of a fairly radical variety.
His activism continued for decades, including time writing for an NGO, participating in marches, and actively campaigning for environmental awareness. But then something changed.
The last 10 years in particular have really demonstrated the limits of what environmental campaigning can do, which is not the fault of campaigners. It's just the world that we're stuck in. This enormous growth economy, moving faster than we've ever moved, than it's ever moved. Human population numbers soaring unstoppably. The climate changing now, and the greenhouse gas emissions being at record levels despite 20 years of attempts to stop them doing so. And all of these other terrible bad luck stories we keep hearing about, the sort of grim environmental news. Only last week we were treated to the news that 50% of the world's wildlife has disappeared in the last 40 years. Quite astonishing. I mean, I'm 41, so that's basically in my lifetime half of the world's wildlife has gone. I was interested in the way that was reported because the headline in the newspaper here that I read was 50% of world's wildlife lost in the last 40 years. And I thought, it's not lost, is it? It hasn't just disappeared. You didn't drop it out of your pocket. We killed it. Our civilization, our species, and all of the things that we enjoy, and all of the little gadgets and the lifestyles and the assumptions we have, that's what's done it. I don't see a way at the moment to turn that machine around. So I kind of hit that point about 5 years ago where I sort of lost faith in what I was doing and lost faith in the ability to change things on a grand scale. And I've never got that faith back.
Many of us feel despair when we see the damage that humans are doing to the planet. A lot of us don't know where to go next.
Having sort of gone through a period of despair about that, as many people do, I started to wonder what was on the other side of the despair and to think about what I could still usefully do as a writer, as a person, as a father, as a human being in a world in which I have a lot less control than I once thought I had. But I'm still here, I'm still alive, and there's still things worth doing. And one of the things that came out of this kind of period of questioning and stepping back and worrying and sometimes despairing was this organization I'm now helping to run called the Dark Mountain Project, which we started in 2009. And it started as a very small manifesto written by myself and another writer. And it was really a manifesto for writers. It wasn't an activist manifesto.
Everybody says Kings North's given up on hope. You know, I just don't really buy that. I feel like it's a mischaracterization of his work, because if you actually read Dark Mountain, the literature that Dark Mountain puts out, he believes that humans are just going to have to dramatically change the way that we live. And it's unclear how at this point. And so Dark Mountain is a space where artists and storytellers can get together to try to answer those questions.
At the root of this crisis, I think, are stories, actually. It's not even primarily technological, economic, spiritual. It's a crisis of narratives. It's the way that we believe we live in the world, our assumption about our ability to dominate nature, our assumption about human superiority, our assumptions about science and technology and growth and all of these other things, which are very specific cultural narratives that most other human cultures have not shared, which have caused the problem we're in. So what new narratives might we create? We wondered, and we started this little, what was intended to be a small group of writers, and it very quickly became quite a big international network of writers and artists and thinkers and activists and all sorts of people who seem to think it's time to start, firstly, being honest about the real state of the world and our abilities to change it or otherwise, and secondly, thinking about what stories we could tell that would help us to see things differently, help us to shift it a little bit.
When you talk about stories, what exactly do you mean? What are the old stories that you think have failed us, and what might the new stories look like?
A culture or a civilization tends to tell itself things about the world that it lives in order to make sense of the world. That's what the human brain does, really. It tells itself stories. It constructs a narrative that makes sense of the images that it sees and the things that the human being walks through. And a different culture, a different civilization, will tell a different story. So in medieval Europe, for example, the story we told was a Christian story, and it was a very state Christian story as well, about a particular type of God and humanity's particular place in the universe. Socially, a story was told about the power of the king, the power of the aristocracy, the ownership of land, the importance of hierarchy, relationships between men and women, for example. And those constructed a framework through which people saw the world. If you were a member of say, some of the indigenous tribes in the Amazon who don't have a word for war and don't have a word for conflict, or if you were an Australian Aborigine who was walking the song lines and saw time as a plane and didn't see particular change throughout history, or if you were a member of an Indian culture, particularly Hindu culture, in which there was no narrative of linear progress, everything was a circle, and it kept spiraling around and then collapsing and rising again, you would be telling yourself a different kind of story about the world. The one that we're in, that we're stuck in at the moment, and which has become a kind of global narrative, or at least a very globalized narrative, is this Western Enlightenment scientific progressive narrative. So some of the key elements of that story are the centrality of humanity on Earth, our sense that we're at the top of a sort of evolutionary tree, that we're a unique species, and effectively the Earth is now ours and we have a duty to control it.
But there's a huge challenge in recognizing your own narratives and the ways in which it shapes our actions and worldview. In your Tricycle essay, you wrote that during your first meditation retreat, one of the key insights that you had was that there's a difference between the world as it is and your perception of it.
Yeah, well, precisely. I mean, I when I went on that retreat, I sort of felt broken open in a particular way, in a very good way. And I did see that, in a way that I hadn't seen before, that I could look at everything that existed outside my body in any number of different ways. And it became very clear to me, not just intellectually. I mean, intellectually, obviously, you can understand this at any time, but one of the things that Buddhism can do for me and for many others I know is to allow you to understand things powerfully at a level that's way beyond or beneath what the intellect can do and what the rational mind can do. So I could see the world during that period and for quite a long time after it as something which I was clearly projecting my stories onto. I was clearly projecting my emotional needs onto, and my fears and my worries. I would, for a long time, over quite a few years, I would not be able to look at a beautiful place or a beautiful landscape, would not be able to walk through a wood, would not be able to stand on the sea, stand on the shore and look at the sea or experience a sunset without automatically thinking that at some stage all of this was going to be destroyed. And it was very debilitating. It was a kind of function of some of the depression I was going through at the time, I suppose. And I've heard a lot of other people saying a similar thing.
This is where Buddhist practice has really helped King's North in helping him recognize his projected narratives.
One of the things I find most powerful about Buddhism is that it gives you a method to cut those strings all the time, all these strings that you reach out and cling to and connect to, so that you can make your stories right, so that you can see the world in a particular way and justify and shore up your way of seeing.
So what is central to the stories that we're telling ourselves about ourselves?
So, for example, the anthropocentric narrative, the human-centered worldview in which the Earth is our playground, the rest of it is simply a collection of natural resources which can either be plundered or protected, but certainly can't be regarded as kind of a living network of things necessarily. The very scientific or scientistic assumption that unless you can demonstrate that another creature has consciousness, it's best to assume that it doesn't. All this kind of stuff is a very particular and very weird worldview, actually, compared to most of those that have been held throughout history. I think that these are stories which have contributed to damaging the fabric of the Earth. So what might the new ones be that would help us to live a more sane existence? I mean, the difficulty there, of course, is that we kind of know what the other stories are. We know that it's possible to see the world in a more ecocentric way, if you like. It's possible to question the paradigms of growth and progress and all the rest of it. It's not as if those stories haven't been explored or haven't existed in other cultures. The real question is how to make them meaningful in a world in which the particular worldview at the moment is so dominant. And that's the difficult one, to which there aren't necessarily any easy answers or any answers.
Yeah, I've always seen a tension in Buddhism between passive acceptance and active engagement. Some Buddhist teachers will say accepting reality as it is the heart of the Dharma, but other Buddhist teachers will point out that compassion is the heart of the Dharma, and so being actively engaged in reducing the suffering of other sentient beings is important.
Well, firstly, I think that I'm very new to Buddhism, So I'm very much at the beginning of a path, so I'm not in a position to start sort of pronouncing about what's right or wrong. As I see it, it seems that Buddhism is absolutely about the necessity of accepting reality, however hard it is. Which, by the way, is what Dark Mountain has always been about as well. Not that it's a Buddhist organization, but since I've got further into Buddhism, I've recognized some connections between the two things. But this need to accept reality, however hard you find it, and this need to ask yourself difficult questions, and this need to avoid delusions. This word seems to come up all the time in Buddhism, the importance of avoiding delusions when you're looking at the world, and it's so crucial. And we are all apt to delude ourselves about how important we are in the world, what the world is, how important our stories are, what we can do to change things, whether we're going to live after we die, whether there's a God, whatever our particular concern is. It's so easy for us to delude ourselves, and for me anyway, the heart of Buddhism is about trying to see through those delusions and cut them all away and seeing what you're left standing with. I don't see that that's necessarily inimical to doing something about injustice. Again, for me, you know, Buddhism seems to, the other word that comes up all the time, as well as delusion, is compassion, which is, again, at the heart of Buddhism. And if you're acting from compassion all the time, sometimes you will be compelled to get involved in some things that we might call activism, whether it's for social justice issues or whether it's for ecological issues. If you want to go and tie yourself to a bulldozer to protect the destruction of a forest, that seems to me to be a compassionate act. So I don't see, personally, any contradiction between the need to sit and focus on reality and not be deluded and understand how you can cut away your need to cling to it and being compassionate in the world. I think it's probably part of the problem is people's desire to kind of put themselves in boxes or to be part of a movement of something that has to oppose a movement of something else. And for me, it all seems like an individual struggle.
Zen practice is sometimes described as a goalless practice, meaning that you have to let go of any expectations of results from your practice. But speaking personally and for a lot of other people that I know, most people agree that there are benefits to practicing. But you only get those benefits if you let go of expectations. I wonder if that's something that you're trying to get at with the Dark Mountain Project.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. I think maybe that's another one of the kind of crossovers between Dark Mountain and what I've found in Zen practice as well. It's because when I first started writing about this kind of thing with Dark Mountain, when I started writing about the failures of environmentalism and the limits of activism, one of the common responses I got from activists, often not from other people, but certainly from people who were still involved in environmental activism, was a kind of angry response, and they would say that I was giving up, and I was encouraging other people to give up, and that this was irresponsible. I shouldn't be doing this, and I was burnt out, and I should be quiet because action was needed to save the world. And it was the construction of this kind of binary idea that on the one hand, there's activism where a goal is set and the goal must be achieved, or there's giving up, and that's a failure, and there's nothing in between. And I think I've come to the conclusion, and Zen has helped me to come to this conclusion, that it's precisely actually all about the practice. Often Zen teachers will say everything you are doing is Zen. If you do it in a certain way, there isn't an expectation. Washing up is Zen. Walking across the room is Zen. It's about doing what you can do, cutting away the delusions, following that truth, being in that moment, without having an expectation of what the result is necessarily going to be. But like you say, there is a result. So if you were to translate that into the field of environmental activism or ecological thought, you might say that getting involved in an enormous global campaign to stop climate change happening within the next 10 years, with a goal that ambitious, which is 99% likely to fail, is to set yourself up for a kind of misery and disillusion. But that the alternative to that is not to do nothing and simply sit down and say, there isn't anything we can do, so there's no point in acting. It's to do what you think is right and real based on what you understand about reality, with no necessary expectation of what is going to come of it, but something will come of it. You know, I sit down and I write an article about something like this. I don't know what will come of it, but things happen. People write to me, people read it, it changes them. You can go out into your garden and you can work there for 3 hours and that will change you and it will change the place in some way, and you don't necessarily ever know what that change will be, but there will be something there. So just kind of being in that truth, being in that place, and acting from compassion and from following that path without having to project a goal onto it. Certainly at the moment for me, that's a way of making sense of what can still be useful.